Hello and welcome to Tour de Table, a podcast series dedicated to a bilingual discussion of the political, economic, and security challenges confronting our world and whether and how Canada is prepared to address them. I'm Jennifer Welsh, Professor of Global Governance and Security at McGill University, where I direct the Center for International Peace and Security Studies.
Et je m'appelle Frédéric Mérand, professeur et directeur du département de sciences politiques de l'Université de Montréal.
We're recording this episode of Tour de Table just one day before the first anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, one of the most significant geopolitical events of the last three decades. In this episode, we wanted to take the opportunity to reflect on the war's relationship to wider geopolitical trends, particularly the relationships between the United States, Russia, and China. The war has not only reconfigured Europe's security and fundamentally transformed the foreign and security policies of many states, it's also deepened and reshaped rivalries between the U.S. and both China and Russia, and created new dynamics between Russia and China, as symbolized by the visit of China's top diplomat, Wang Yi, to Moscow this week. So to help us unpack how the war has impacted international security and influenced great power relations, we're joined in today's episode by Dr. Bruce Jones. Bruce is director and senior fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. His research and policy expertise focuses on international security, particularly U.S. strategy, international order, and great power relations. He has a PhD from the London School of Economics and was a Hamburg Fellow in Conflict Prevention at Stanford University. Bruce has also served in several capacities at the UN as senior advisor to Kofi Annan on UN reform, as deputy research director to the UN's high-level panel on threats, challenges, and change, as well as lead scholar for the International Task Force on Global Public Goods. Bruce also served in the UN's operation in Kosovo and was special assistant to the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process. His most recent book, To Rule the Waves, How Control of the World's Oceans Shapes the Fate of the Superpowers, examines the critical role that oceans play in the struggle for global power. Thanks so much, Bruce, for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on this show.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So in a meeting that we were at together late last spring, you described Russia's invasion of Ukraine as falling under the umbrella of China's bigger and sustained challenge to the current international order. Can you tell us a bit more about why you see it that way and how this year of the conflict illustrates the challenge?
Yeah, thanks. So first of all, I think that it's the case that Putin, in assessing his capacity for risk-taking, his capacity to challenge the West, does so in the context of looking at the bigger picture. Where is the West weak? Where are we divided? Where are we challenged? What issues do we confront? And he's well aware that, certainly seen from an American perspective, the big challenge is not Russia, it's China. Our defense priority is China. Our strategic priority is China. Our diplomatic priority is China. Russia is a very important second order priority, but it is a second order priority, not a first order priority. And what that means is that there's a great deal of American strategic capability is oriented towards the Western Pacific, not Eastern Europe. And so I think he assessed correctly that there would be limits to the extent to which the United States was prepared to deploy strategic capability of all types into land warfare in Europe while it was preoccupied by this, what the United States sees as a much wider challenge from China. And then specifically, if you look at the meeting that he had with Xi Jinping at the Beijing Olympics in the lead up to the Ukraine war, I think it's pretty clear that he was waiting for a chance to tell President Xi in person what he was planning in Ukraine. We don't know what extent he briefed him, but he certainly briefed him in advance and was looking for and got a clear green light from Beijing to go ahead with the invasion. If you go back and you look at the Russian invasion of Georgia in 2008, that began China was extremely careful in its statements. And the minute China turned towards statements that talked about defense of territory, integrity of sovereign territory, etc., the Russian advance stopped. It was very clear that he was carefully reading the Chinese diplomatic signals to see how far he could go in terms of the kind of top cover that Beijing provides him. He would never put it this way, but Russia is obviously the junior partner in that partnership, and he has to have that top cover. We saw that, too, in terms of the nuclear threats. It was not American diplomacy that turned off the nuclear threats. It was Chinese and Indian diplomacy that turned off the nuclear threats from Putin. So he operates in an umbrella defined by the challenge that China poses to the United States. And we've seen the President of the United States repeatedly through this year, and including in his national security statement and the State of the Union, define China as the pacing challenge for the Department of Defense, as the core strategic challenge for the United States. And everything the United States is doing vis-a-vis Ukraine is seen through that prism of the wider China challenge.
So just help me understand the counterfactual then. Of the last year, had he not had the green light, he might not have engaged in the type of action he did.
I think it's likely that he would have done something, but not nearly as much as he chose to do. I think he probably would have reinforced his positions in the Donbass and in the Crimea, maybe would have pushed a little further territorially in the east. But a full-scale invasion of Ukraine without Chinese top cover, I sincerely doubt it.
Interesting. And so if we just beam closer to today, at the recent Munich Security Conference, Secretary of State Antony Blinken indicated that he was worried about China making a move to provide lethal support to Russia's war effort. Does Wang Yi's visit to Moscow increase that likelihood? And what do you think China's goals for this war are?
For it to be over. This is an embarrassment for the Chinese. They're embarrassed by their kind of close embrace of Putin just as he started this. They're embarrassed by the position it puts them in the global south. They've had to spend an enormous amount of diplomatic energy covering Putin's back in the global south. It's embarrassing for them that their core strategic ally is performing so badly. It's very awkward for them to watch Russian weaponry performing so badly. This war is doing nothing positive for China. I see very little evidence that China is actually moving towards providing lethal support to Russia's war effort. Very little evidence. Now, obviously, Secretary of State sees intelligence that I don't see. But even in conversations with knowledgeable members of the intelligence community here, the kinds of things that they are pointing to are things like, well, Iran has increased its energy sales to China, and it's using some of those profits to fund weapon sales to Russia. Well, okay, sure. I would hardly count that as China providing lethal aid to the Russians, let alone trying to compare it to what we're doing. But even leaving that question aside, I don't see it as providing lethal aid. I don't see it as likely that China is going to be providing direct military support. They are providing important economic support. They're providing important diplomatic support. There's no question. Wang Yi's visit to Moscow, which happened to correspond with Biden's visit to Kiev, was designed to signal, despite how embarrassing this has been, despite how negatively this has gone, they're not giving up on the Russian partnership. They don't really have any choice. They don't have any other partners who are going to kind of help them pressure NATO and help them pressure the West. So I think it was designed to signal we're not giving up on the Russians. They may try to find some ways in the tech sector to bolster, not so much the Russian war effort, I think, but maybe the Russian rearmament effort after the war. Right now it's going to be very hard for the Russians to produce high-tech weaponry, given the kind of restrictions on chip sales and technology sales to the Russians. China might be able to help it with that. Frankly, China has its own needs, and I would guess that its own needs take a way higher priority than helping the Russians refurbish. But there'll be negotiations there. The Chinese are very keen to get access to Russia's much more sophisticated submarine technology. The Russians have been very leery about sharing that. So there could be deals being cut in terms of tech sharing in the military space that we're not going to be aware of. I think it's very unlikely we're going to see sort of shipments of Chinese weaponry to the Russians. I don't think that's what we're talking about here.
It's interesting because when I heard the Secretary of State say that, I had the same reaction. I thought, I can't imagine the Chinese overtly doing that. And so I asked myself, you know, what was in Blinken's mind? Was it an attempt to make a statement about how delicate the West sees the military situation on the ground right now and wants to almost preempt by saying, look, this is a war that we're heavily engaged in. Don't even think about this.
I presume so. I presume it was designed to deter. I don't think they would have done it if they hadn't had some intelligence suggesting there was debates around this or movement around this. You know, for all of the fact that we all emphasize, oh, she's in complete control, etc., Beijing is still a complicated bureaucratic military industrial city, and there's a lot of debate and foment and back and forth, and people in the defense industrial complex are going to be pushing for more sales to the Russians, and others would be pushing against. And so we may have been picking up some of that chatter. I don't know. I'm just speculating. I doubt he would have said it on the basis of no intel, but I have a hard time seeing the kind of direct support in those terms coming to pass. Well, I could be badly surprised. And by the way, let's be clear, like I say that now, this might look very different a year from now.
Yes. Yeah. Depending on how long the war continues.
Yeah. And how bad things get for the Russians, how bad things, the Ukrainians start to show signs of weakness, the West starts to splinter. I mean, you can, you know, the calculations could change. Right now, I think it's unlikely.
So the other way in which China's been connected in different ways to the conflict is through observations about the similarities. I think there are also big differences between this case and Taiwan. You've also said recently that you think it's highly likely that there will be a Chinese challenge in the Taiwan Straits within 5 years. So if that's the case, what do you think China's learning from the war in Ukraine that might affect the timing and the nature of that challenge?
Yeah, a couple of points here. So first of all, let's be clear. Like I think that if we play life out over the next 5 years, the odds that we aren't facing a crisis in the Taiwan Strait are very low. But that's not only because of a potential Chinese move. It's also because we've got large amounts of Chinese, Taiwanese, and American and allied capacity sailing around those waters, preparing for a range of scenarios, preparing, you know, wargaming, exercising, et cetera. The odds of an accident, of misinterpretation of signals, of all sorts of things going wrong that generate a crisis are, you know, part of what I include in that set of the likelihood within the five-year period. And 5 years, by the way, it could be seven, could be three, you know, within a very narrow window of time, I think we're facing that challenge. I think a couple of things play into this. I'm skeptical that the Chinese are spending a ton of time studying Ukrainian tactics and mapping it onto the Taiwanese defense capabilities. They're very different. The geography is dramatically different. Taiwan is an extremely mountainous island. That's very different than a very flat, landlocked eastern country, right? They're just completely different in terms of war fighting tactics. They may be learning a few things from drone warfare and et cetera. I think the big things are this. One, there's every indication that Beijing was badly surprised by the incredible sophistication of the American and operational intelligence on what the Russians were going to do, where they were going to do it, when they were going to do it, how many people they're going to do it with, et cetera. Badly surprised by that. The automatic assumption would be that if they have that degree of fidelity in their operational intelligence on Russia's movements in Western Ukraine, they probably have it on our movements in the Taiwan Strait. And that's probably accurate, right? So I think that gave them serious grounds for pause. Second real answer is we don't know between two things. You could look at Ukraine and say, yeah, the West is responding more than we thought. You could also look at Ukraine and say, yes, when push comes to shove, the West is not going to send its own troops to fight and defend non-allied territory. Both of those things are true. Which of them applies in Taiwan is speculative. And we don't know what speculation they're making. Frankly, we're also making our own speculations, right? We're also engaged in an ongoing debate in Washington and in the West about to what extent, if at all, we would mount a defense of Taiwan. I think it's highly likely we would mount a defense, but of what nature is it? Weapons shipments? Is it American troops showing up? Is it American ships getting involved in the fight? Those are fundamentally different things. And last point is, you know, these are very, very different wars. Ukraine is a land war. Taiwan is, in the first instance, a naval war. The superiority of the American submarine fleet is a very serious deterrent to China here. But as China builds out and builds out and builds out and builds out its surface fleet, you know, its capability to do a Taiwan scenario grows and grows. And so I think there are sharp limits to the extent to which the Ukraine crisis offers direct lessons. We can't resupply Taiwan the same way we've been able to resupply Ukraine. The shipping lanes will be extremely vulnerable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the intelligence piece is very important. And what we will, you know, we may eventually know historically is how did they understand the nature of the West response, which is ambiguous.
Ambiguous.
Avec Taïwan, on commence à parler des océans, du grand large, et Jennifer a mentionné tout à l'heure que vous veniez de faire paraître un livre sur le rôle que jouent les océans dans la géopolitique. C'est une vieille question en géopolitique, évidemment. Bien que les combats en Ukraine se déroulent principalement sur la terre, et vous l'avez rappelé, c'est landlocked, c'est enserré essentiellement par ses voisins, il y a quand même une composante navale dans ce conflit qui a eu des conséquences énormes, par exemple, sur la navigation en mer Noire. Je me demandais si vous pouviez nous parler un peu de cette dimension maritime du conflit et de ses répercussions.
Ouais, merci de la question. And by the way, I should say, when I use the word landlocked, and that's obviously inaccurate, I mean, it borders the Black Sea, but there are, of course, where we're fighting in the northern Donbass, there are only land routes into that. Yeah, so I think that the crisis in the Black Sea has helped us understand something that we could write 20 books about globalization and 20 books about maritime power, and a crisis reveals much more than any books. It helps us understand that globalization moves by sea. Globalization is a maritime enterprise, right? The vast bulk of commercial trade, industrial trade, energy trade, and agricultural trade moves by sea. And so when you have a crisis in a transshipment sea, as the Black Sea is, in this case for fertilizer and agricultural goods, it has immediate global consequences. And we've seen that in the way that the kind of leaching of the fight into the Black Sea immediately threatened shipments of grain and other agricultural goods from both Russia and Ukraine and fertilizer from Russia to markets worldwide. It's a huge proportion of the world's fertilizer comes out of those two countries, and a very large proportion of grain and corn that comes out of those two countries as well. And so immediate impacts on global food markets, a risk of 80 million additional people being thrust into famine risk this year, etc. We then saw, of course, the Black Sea grain deal put in place by the Turks and the UN. And so that's been, we sort of facilitated a partial solution to that. It's not a total solution. That deal is at risk. I think there's a serious worry about it not being renewed in March. The fertilizer sales on the Russian side have not been working properly, sort of obscure EU regulatory issues, but it's not working properly. So there is a risk there. But it does illustrate quite how much of our economies, all of our economies, are tied into the movement of goods by sea. And when you take a body of water through which trade passes and turn it into a conflict zone, that almost immediately cripples the capacity of shipping to move through that lens for security reasons, for insurance reasons, et cetera. Just imagine what that means if we're thinking about the Taiwan Strait, where 50% of world trade moves through those waters versus, 6% or something in the Black Sea. So, but it's an extremely important illustration of how much the global economy and each of our individual economies is deeply dependent on the movement of goods by sea and how quickly that can be put at risk.
Donc, il y a l'économie mondiale, mais cette histoire des céréales et des fertilisants nous a aussi rappelé ou mis en relief des lignes de fracture importantes entre les pays pauvres du Sud qui estimaient finalement souffrir des conséquences d'une guerre qui ne les concernait pas. Et dans un épisode précédent de Tour de table, on a abordé cette question un petit peu des pays importants pauvres comme l'Inde, le Pakistan, l'Afrique du Sud, qui se sont abstenus de condamner l'invasion de la Russie à l'ONU. On verra s'ils vont continuer à le faire dans les prochains mois. Vous, dans un article de Foreign Affairs paru en juin, vous avez fait valoir que les États-Unis devraient adopter ce que vous avez appelé une approche plus granulaire lorsqu'ils traitent avec les pays non alignés. Pouvez-vous nous expliquer ce que vous entendez par là? À quoi ça ressemblerait en pratique une approche granulaire à l'endroit de ces nombreux pays qui ne sont plus nécessairement alignés derrière les États-Unis.
How long do we have? look, my first point, and I'll
try not to bore your audience by my diatribe on this. I cannot tell you how badly it lands when Western diplomats and American diplomats, sometimes in particular European diplomats, sometimes in particular, go into the international space and talk about a rules-based order. I mean, this is just nonsense, okay? We should ban the phrase rules-based order from our vocabulary. First of all, nobody can define the damn thing. Nobody knows what's in it, what's out of it, et cetera. It's all, I mean, to my mind, it's an extraordinarily weak intellectual phrase. But as a diplomatic phrase, it's a disaster. Why? Let's just stay in the security space for a second, okay? Have we faced other wars that threatened Article 2 of the Charter? Not in the form of a major power seeking to annex territory. The Ethiopia-Eritrea war was a threat to Article 2 of the Charter. 300,000 people died in that war. Did it cause a Zeitenwende in Germany? Did the President of the United States make articles about defense of the rules-based order? And, the Second Congo War, which international war, to kill 2.5 million people? Did it create a global diplomatic crisis? No. So the South, looking at our response to Ukraine, we're all Ukrainians, it's a global issue. Frankly, their reaction is, no, it's not. You weren't there when we faced these crises. I mean, you might have sent some peacekeepers, but you were not there in the kind of deep political sense you are in Ukraine. And don't expect us to be in response to yours. Which doesn't mean they like what the Russians are doing in Ukraine. Doesn't mean they like Putin, whatever. But they don't feel the sense of we have to be in solidarity with the West when the West wasn't in solidarity with them. That's even if we just stay to the security issues. Then you take the fundamental extent to which the United States did not stand in solidarity with the South and the West did not stand in solidarity with the South during COVID. Then you take the fact that the rules, such as they are written by us. They benefit us primarily. We abuse them all the time. And they're major obstacles to the growth of the South. They're major obstacles to the South having voting weight at key institutions. We're the guardians at the gate of those institutions and of those voting weights and of those rules. Why on earth would they rally in defense of rules that are frankly a significant obstacle to them in terms of their economic agenda, their growth, their trade, their climate issues, and their voice in global politics? So the whole framing is just completely wrong. So first of all, you have to kind of get rid of that stuff. And then I think you have to go into the kind of more granular question of sort of what is it that India wants in the international system, South Africa, et cetera. If I just take India, look, they have fundamental stakes in the international trade regime, fundamental stakes in the international finance regime, fundamental stakes in the energy transition. And we are opponents of their interests on each of those regimes, right, in which the rules are set. So if we approach India as, well, they should sort of support the rules-based order just because they don't like the Chinese, we're completely misunderstanding their relationship to the international order. Yes, they are increasingly with us on China. That's a good thing. But they are not with us on the rules of the international financial institutions or the rules of the international economic order. And quite frankly, they're quite keen to have China be successful in slapping us around a fair amount and opening up space. They don't want China to replace the West as the dominant actor in shaping the rules, but that's not in the cards. What they see China doing successfully is pushing against the West and having more space for developing countries to have voice in the shaping of the rules. And they're very happy to see China do that, and they're quite willing to work with China to help make that happen. And so in the international economic order, they are not with us in the rules-based order, which doesn't exist. But, it does at least exist a little bit in the international economic domain. They are not with us there. And so to approach it that way is just to get all of this badly wrong. So we're wrong on the solidarity, we're wrong on the rules-based order, and we're wrong on their approach. That's just exactly the wrong way to try to mobilize global support for what's happening in Ukraine. There is a lot of sympathy for Ukraine in these countries. There's a lot of distaste for Putin in the civil societies, not necessarily in the government. Some of these governments are closely aligned with Putin for weapon sales and other reasons. But we're just tapping into all the wrong sentiments in the way we've approached that diplomacy.
Moi, je trouve ça très intéressant d'abord d'admettre qu'il y a eu deux poids, deux mesures, donc les double standards dont on parle souvent, et puis d'offrir finalement quelque chose qui est intéressant pour la construction des relations internationales à des pays comme l'Inde. ce serait certainement plus efficace que la stratégie qui est adoptée jusqu'à maintenant, qui est de rappeler à ces pays que le droit international a été bafoué et ça pourrait leur arriver à eux aussi. Mais la question que je me pose, c'est la suivante. Est-ce qu'à Washington, par exemple, on est prêt à faire ce changement de calcul à l'endroit, par exemple, de l'Inde?
Je ne sais pas. I think with India, there's at least a chance. Huh? And by the way, it's interesting. You do see some... The United States was in the lead on the kind of resolution to the UN, talk about rules-based order, etc. But bilaterally, I actually see more nuance in the American position on these issues than in the European position, especially vis-a-vis India. So when India was buying oil from the Russians, the Europeans were going bananas, and the Americans were a little bit more understanding, right? And frankly, when you consider that the Europeans, until very late in the game, refused to cut off gas sales from the Russians, it was spectacularly hypocritical. And the Indians, of course, are fully aware of that. The Americans were more nuanced, and the Americans don't have the colonial history that continues to be baggage for the Europeans. So it was very interesting, for example, when Tony Blinken went to South Africa, the South African foreign minister, who's a real voice of the kind of, you know, I call it the sort of the New South Rising, and she's a real voice of that, was extremely tough on the Europeans, but was very careful to say, you know, my friend sitting here, Tony, is less bad. He didn't praise him, but she said, essentially, you guys have gotten this less wrong than the Europeans. And I think that's often right. So some of this is baggage, and the U.S. has less of it than the Europeans. When it comes to India, there's such an overweening interest in building ties with India through the Quad and et cetera, that I think that will help create some openness to a shift in position. You know, a major thorn in everybody's side was the issue of finance for climate adaptation. The United States finally gave ground on that. I think they did that stupidly, sort of conceding at the very last moment rather than actually changing position as part of a kind of different approach to solidarity with the South. But nonetheless, they have changed position. So yeah, I think there is some openness to it. The votes at the UN were a bit of a wake-up call. People here were surprised by it, and it created some opportunities to talk to them about why it is the South isn't the Global South isn't with us in these terms. I think some other places are a little harder for them to take this from. The UAE and Saudi Arabia is like, come on, guys, are you serious? You know, Israel was a little hard to take when they were abstaining or showing sort of vacillating on whether they're going to be with the Russians or et cetera. But from India, from South Africa, from Brazil, I think there has been a bit of a willingness to understand what that's about and to look harder. Now, whether that does that mean we're about to change our policy, the WTO, or, you know, no. But at least there could be a sort of a different type of negotiation, a different kind of understanding, and it might create some space for some bargains that need to be cut, especially with India.
So turning to some other questions relating to geopolitics, and I think one that has been on everybody's minds throughout this war is the nuclear question, which has raised its head at different times and in lots of different ways. But this week, at least, earlier this week, Vladimir Putin announced that Russia would suspend its participation in the New START arms control treaty. That was one of the last remaining pieces of the arms control architecture. So what do you think this means for global security, but particularly for American nuclear strategy?
I'm inclined to be very careful here in not overreacting to this. He suspended participation. He did not announce a new program of building weapons or an expansion of targets or anything like that. I don't honestly know what the status is, but I would be surprised if there were large numbers of American inspectors roaming around Russian nuclear sites right now or vice versa. Anyway, it's not like there's been particularly good compliance with the terms of the New START treaty in the last several years. Anyway, certainly under these conditions, he didn't withdraw from it. Do we think that Russia is about to start building large numbers of new nuclear weapons? I'd be surprised that they have the technology and the resources for that right now. Where they were and are expanding their nuclear stockpile in very dangerous ways is on an issue that's not covered by New START, which is in submarine nuclear launched unmanned torpedoes, very dangerous weapon, not covered by New START.
So I'm not sure that the suspension of New START itself is a very bad signal diplomatically, but we were in the toilet diplomatically anyway, right? So I'm not sure it's such an important issue in narrow terms. The much bigger issue in my mind is that for all intents and purposes, for several years now, we have had no serious arms control negotiations between the world's three largest armed forces, the United States, China, and Russia. And frankly, I don't really see that changing much until China's stockpile is quite a lot larger than it is now. I can't see any reason for the Chinese to be in the business of arms limitation talks in the nuclear space. They might be on cyber and AI and other kinds of things, but in the nuclear space, I can't see them willing to participate in any kind of strategic limitation talks until their stockpile is a lot closer to ours and the Russians than it is now, and that's several years off. So there are some significant limits to how much we can expect out of arms control in the coming period, which is a bad thing, which is very worrying. But it's a bigger problem than just the New START question. And in the short term, I don't think it's likely to change that. My focus is much more on crisis mitigation guardrails, sort of hotlines and, you know, instant at sea agreements and those kinds of things. You know, if we face a Taiwan scenario, we will face that. But what we don't want to have to do is end up in a shooting war with the Chinese because some sea captain someplace bumped into some other sea captain accidentally, right? That's not where we want to be. But we don't have those guardrails in place in the Western Pacific. We've shredded most of the guardrails we have in place with the Russians. So reinventing some of those is going to be very hard to do, but that's, to my mind, the urgent business, is to reinvent those crisis escalation mechanisms so that accidental escalation doesn't occur. We're some years off from actual arms limitation.
It's interesting, just on that point about crisis mechanisms, I recall you also offering the perspective that while everyone wrings their hands about how paralyzed the UN Security Council is at present, given the configuration of permanent members and veto powers, that maybe we should start looking at the council as a venue for this kind of crisis management. And that's a different way of conceiving what it can do in a very different geopolitical environment.
Right. That's exactly right. It's, you know, it was not designed to be an instrument by which the West sent stabilizing mechanisms out into the developing world, which is how we've used it for the last 40 years. It was designed as a mechanism where all the major powers were present and could either jointly operate or resolve differences. And we used it that way pretty extensively in the Arab-Israeli wars. In every one of those wars and in several other crises as well, you would find the Americans and the Soviets meeting at the council to negotiate ceasefires of their respective partners or proxies and to put in place sort of oversight management. That's where peacekeeping is born, is where mediation was born, was in those U.S.-Soviet negotiations on escalation control at the council. So my view has for some time been that we have to reimagine it in those terms, remember that that's what it's for. Obviously, it takes two to tango. If the Russians don't want to stop the war, the council isn't going to be a useful venue. But if we get to a point where there's a willingness in Moscow to enter into serious negotiations, I think it would not surprise me if the council plays quite an important role in that. It's very important in the Russian diplomatic psychology to be a permanent member, to have that sort of role played. They're not going to want to do this in European context. They're going to want to do it mano a mano with the Americans at the council. And we have to remain open to that. And so the stuff that's out there about let's kick the Russians off the council, that stuff is pointless. A, we couldn't do it, and B, we don't want to, because we actually need mechanisms where we can meet with them and engage in de-escalation talks and make agreements to put in de-escalation mechanisms. Again, that doesn't generate their willingness to move this way. That has to come through our deterrent capability and Ukrainian success. But if we get to a point, or when we get to a point where Moscow is willing to engage in negotiations, the council will be likely to be the mechanism. And, you know, over time, it wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing U.S.-China talks at the council playing a similar role. We've seen that vis-a-vis the Iran situation, which everybody forgets about, but is another kind of major issue in world politics. Frequently, negotiations with the Iran deal have been done in the margins of the council. P5+1 mechanism is obviously kind of where the deal was anchored. I think we will likely see the council play that role, and we should think about the council in that way, versus how we've used it over the last 30 to 40 years, which is in a very different tone of voice.
On a déjà commencé à se tourner vers l'avenir et j'ai envie de vous poser une dernière question. Bruce, vous avez écrit à propos du plan Marshall, auquel on attribue une bonne partie de la reconstruction de l'Europe, et avec l'OTAN aussi, l'alignement de l'Europe sur les États-Unis après la Deuxième Guerre mondiale. Lorsque la guerre en Ukraine se terminera ou se transformera en conflit gelé, en nouvelle guerre froide peut-être, bon, il faudra reconstruire l'Ukraine, il faudra aussi sécuriser l'Ukraine. Qui va payer, qui va garantir la sécurité de l'Ukraine? Est-ce que ce sera, selon vous, la tâche des États-Unis, de l'Union européenne? Est-ce que quelqu'un va prendre cette responsabilité?
Yeah. Well, I very much hope that there will be a variety of domestic and international legislations passed that will allow us to take Mr. Putin's ill-gained funds and use some of them for the reconstruction. But on a more serious note, I do hope that's the case, by the way, but a bit more seriously, the couple of points here. I do think it is likely that the American attitude will be that having carried by far and away the larger load of the military response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that it will expect Europe to carry by far and away the lion's share of the reconstruction costs. I think we've already seen the European Bank for Reconstruction and the European Central Bank sort of signal that they're beginning to prepare for this. Berlin is obviously going to play a major role in this. Paris and London will play major roles. European companies are gearing up to be involved, etc. I don't think it's accidental that David Malpass was encouraged to go spend time with his family away from the World Bank. I think they'll put somebody there who's oriented to some combination of the issues with the Global South and the Ukraine reconstruction. Two big issues the bank has to deal with. This is going to be an enormously expensive business. The complications here are legion. We're going to be doing reconstruction under conditions of war. Let's be frank and remember that Ukraine was only 10 notches above Russia on the corruption indexes before the war. I think things have improved since, but it's hardly going to be a place where we can operate without worrying about corruption. There are some experiences of how to handle that in past episodes. My big worry, honestly, this is a technical thing, but I worry that what will happen is that EBRD and ECB and sort of strategic actors in Berlin will be in the lead. They've never really done this before, at least not in sort of recent term. And they won't draw on a lot of the lessons that have been learned in the myriad of other places where we've done this. In the same way that when the Americans went into Afghanistan and started doing post-conflict and post-crisis reconstruction, etc., completely blithely unaware of the fact that this would be done in 40 other cases in the preceding 25 years, and went ahead and made every single mistake it was possible to make that people had made before and learned from. And I worry that we'll see something similar in the Ukraine case, that people will just make endless numbers of mistakes that would be avoidable if they had drawn on the lessons from the 80 cases that we've done this in so far. But it just won't be thought of in those terms. It'll still be thought of as unique and different, and it'll be done by actors that haven't been involved in the other cases. So I worry about that. Give me a huge amount of money pouring into this. It's very easy for that to generate very negative dynamics in a society, corruption, you know, warlordism, I mean, all sorts of things that can go along with that flow of money into society. Zelensky has done an extraordinary job of rallying Ukrainian society in the war effort. We have seen in time after time after time that that does not necessarily translate into that same degree of unity in a reconstruction effort. Maybe he will transcend history in the terms he's also transcended history in the war effort. But I'm worried about that. So I think there's a lot that can go wrong. On the other hand, it's of course vital that it go ahead and that it succeed. And it should start. It should have started already. There's a lot that we could already be doing. Some of what we do now or do soon is going to be, quote, wasted in the sense that the Russians will hit things again. But, you know, the physical reconstruction of infrastructure is always the least important part of this. It's the social and institutional reconstruction of capacity to manage a society, to manage the economy. And if you have to rebuild infrastructure a few times, that's not the end of the world. It's hard to explain that sometimes to donors. But so if, to my mind, we should already be in the business of the economic reconstruction of Ukraine, and that should be an ongoing business. It's going to take a very long time. It's going to cost a great deal of money. We have to, back to an issue we talked about earlier, you know, we have to protect a little bit the global dynamics here. If there's still huge need in the South from the debt crisis, from the overhang of COVID, et cetera, and climate adaptation, and if we pour more money into Ukraine than we do into all of that, the diplomatic consequences of that will be substantial. China isn't going to be a major participant in the Ukraine reconstruction. It leaves them an open space in the South. So we have to be careful in the balancing of this. Obviously, in European terms, Ukraine will be the highest priority, fair enough. But there has to be an eye on the other needs in the international system as well.
So on that note about what comes after the war, we need to wrap up this episode of Tour de Table. We'd like to thank our guest, Bruce Jones, Director and Senior Fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Brookings Institution.
Merci, Bruce.
Thanks for having me on.
To learn more about McGill University's Center for International Peace and Security Studies, please visit us at sepsi-sips.ca. Follow us on Twitter at @sips_McGill. Subscribe for more episodes of Tour de Table available on our website, the website of the Max Bell School, Spotify and Apple Music.
Et vous pouvez aussi en apprendre davantage sur l'Université de Montréal, le département de sciences politiques ou le Centre d'études et de recherche internationales en me suivant sur Twitter ou sur Mastodon où j'aime bien partager les activités et les analyses de mes collègues.
Thank you to our producer Karim Faraj. We hope you enjoyed listening.